and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the bombshell New York Times report that Donald Trump appears to have avoided paying federal income taxes for 18 years after losing $916 million in 1995. David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist who has been called the de facto tax enforcement officer of the United States, and is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Making of Donald Trump, joins us to discuss the tax documents that were mailed anonymously to Suzanne Craig at the New York Times and verified by Trump's accountant at the time, Jack Mitnick. We will assess the responses by Trump's surrogates, Governor Christie and Mayor Giuliani, who both claim Trump is a genius for not paying taxes, while Trump's accountant Mitnick went on the record to acknowledge that Donald Trump has built enormous personal wealth to live a luxurious lifestyle without paying taxes like everyone else. Then we'll look into today's referendum in Hungary that is designed by the ruling right-wing Prime Minister Orbán to stir up xenophobia and neo-fascist vigilantism against refugees in Europe, who Orbán equates with terrorists out to dilute European Christian culture. Peter Krekow, a visiting scholar at the Center for Global International Studies at Indiana University and the director of the Political Capital Institute at Budapest, Hungary, joins us to discuss Putin's role in financing a right-wing counter-revolution against Western European democratic values and federalism, and how his intervention in Syria is contributing to the refugee crisis that is creating social divisions in Europe and inflaming a racist, nativist backlash. Then finally, we'll examine the hacked audio from a fundraiser at which Hillary Clinton broke with the Obama administration's trillion-dollar nuclear modernization plan and said she would kill one of the Pentagon's pet projects, the nuclear-tipped cruise missile, which she described as the last thing we need. Joseph Cerincione, the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons, joins us to discuss how the U.S. is heading in the wrong direction towards more emphasis on nuclear weapons and away from efforts to ease the U.S. and Russia's reliance on a hair-trigger nuclear posture that only gives the president 5 minutes to decide whether or not to retaliate in the face of nuclear annihilation. And joining us now is David K. Johnston, who's an investigative journalist and winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Journalism, a longtime reporter for the New York Times. He's the author of several New York Times bestsellers, including Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch, and has won the IRE Medal and the George Polk Award for his investigative reporting. He's a columnist for The Daily Beast, National Memo, and USA Today. And his latest book is The Making of Donald Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, David K. Johnston.
Well, Ian, thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you, Dave. And I know you're busy today. This is a huge story.
Just a little.
Right, that Suzanne Craig at the New York Times had mailed to her anonymously, and it was verified by Trump's accountant, Jack Mitnick. This isn't, of course, tax returns, but it's also, but it is a window into what Donald Trump is hiding, surely.
Well, yes. The New York Times got were the summary forms, not the tax return. That's everything. For Trump, that would be hundreds and hundreds of pages. The summary form for the state governments of New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut. New York strictly follows federal reporting. So we know then that he reported this $916 million net operating loss. He had been reporting net operating losses for several years before this, so my guess is this is the peak year. And the big question about this is, since Trump was determined by his bankers in the year 1990 to have a negative net worth, minus $295 million, and his bankers wrote down all sorts of loans, which makes the unpaid portion of the loan income. If you borrow money from a bank, don't pay it back, it's income. How did he come up with almost $1 billion of losses to take for his businesses, which most of which were organized as partnerships or the equivalent of a partnership? And that we don't know.
Well, it seems, though, that the accountant who's retired now down in Florida, who used to be Trump's father's accountant, It went on the record to acknowledge that Donald Trump has built an enormous personal wealth to live a luxurious lifestyle without paying taxes like everyone else. And this gets to the question, I mean, it's not hardly a question anymore, that the tax system in this country is done for the benefit of the super wealthy. But the idea...
Right. No, I'm sorry. The point I was trying to make, Ian, I'm sorry if I wasn't clear about this. I mean, I've been writing about the tax system and how it benefits the super wealthy now for more than 20 years as a main focus. But the news story in the New York Times assumes that everything is honest in that tax return, and I'm not so sure that that's the case.
Right.
Donald Trump has a long history of filing two sets of documents with different government agencies that don't match up and that work to his benefit. And Jack Mitnick has given testimony that I broke the story on earlier this year on another Trump tax return that had what are known in the trade as badges of fraud.
Well, it looks like he's double dipping, though, isn't he? If he can write off an unpaid bank loan and then deduct that from his taxes, when you say it's income, which it clearly is that double dipping?
I think that there's a great deal more to be found here about what's going on. But the larger picture, the one that you wanted to go to when I went on the tangent, is correct. Donald Trump is indicative of something that is the biggest open secret among wealthy Americans. If you're rich enough, you don't have to pay taxes. Now, it's hard for people who are successful but not plutocrats to understand this. You know, doctors, successful lawyers, they may make $1 million or $2 million a year, and they feel very heavily taxed. What they don't understand is that when you get way up above that, there are all these special rules that I've been exposing for years. One of them is, instead of having income, you can arrange your affairs so you have wealth and you borrow against the wealth and you tell the government you're a pauper for tax purposes, even though you're flying in a private jet and own a 100-foot-long yacht.
Well, that's what I find extraordinary, is that this is a system that rewards business failure. And, of course, Trump's touting himself as a great businessman, and a lot of his followers actually believe that. But the financial wreckage that he left behind in the early 1990s through the – and we've talked about this before, about this the mismanagement of these Atlantic City casinos, about which he knew nothing, apparently, and wasn't even interested. And then, of course, he apparently got into the airline business in 1995. And then he tried, and then he bought the Plaza Hotel as well. So, how could you have a system that rewards business failure?
Well, we shouldn't have a system that does that. We should have a system that rewards people who build successful businesses. And I think that we need to have a deeper understanding of what Trump did here from these returns. I mean, this thing just screams for Congress to investigate. If there's fraud, there is no statute of limitations on tax fraud. Tax fraud is like murder. You know, if you get caught, doesn't matter how long ago it happened. And we know, and I report in the making of Donald Trump, that Donald participated in sales tax fraud. We know that he has claimed that properties, he says, in his presidential disclosure form are worth more than $50 million. He's claimed are worth as little as $1.3 million for property tax purposes. And we know the badges of fraud in the 84 return. And I've said the last year that we actually know that Donald Trump paid income taxes was 1977, and I would be surprised if he paid much or anything since then because of how he was able to organize his affairs, because Congress has two income tax systems, separate and unequal. One is for wage earners and small business owners and the vast majority of Americans, and that system is rigorous and thorough and efficient. Then there's a system for very, very wealthy people. The Donald Trumps, the Warren Buffetts, the Larry Ellisons, movie stars, and they pay very little tax, and some of them, many of them, including Trump, actually make a profit off the tax system because they get to defer any taxes they owe for years into the future, and they get to invest the money they didn't pay in taxes because the government effectively gives them a zero-interest loan. And this is not the IRS now. The IRS is just the police. It's Congress that does these things.
Well, of course, we can't expect the Congress, this Republican-controlled House and Senate, to initiate any investigations. They have refused to investigate Russia's interference in our elections. At the same time, they've used appearances by the head of the FBI to go after Hillary Clinton's emails and not even deal with what the FBI is complaining about, which is Russia's interference. So that shows you the incredible corruption of these Republicans.
This is an astounding set of developments. Imagine what would have happened if Barack Obama or Bill Clinton or Ronald Reagan or George Bush had said something nice about an autocratic dictator who murders his opponents like Vladimir Putin, or had a debt to a communist Chinese bank like Donald Trump does through one of his businesses, or who had collected tens of millions of dollars from Russian oligarchs who only keep their money as long as they're the friends of Vladimir Putin. All hell would be breaking loose over that. And yet, what are we concerned about? Hillary's emails, her personal emails. There must be something, you know, she's hiding by she falsely claims that they're personal, that, you know, she had destroyed. I mean, this is just an unbelievable set of developments. And now we have this about Trump, and I saw Rudy Giuliani this morning on TV defending this. Well, you know, if you're going to be the Republicans who love war, the only way you finance a war is with tax dollars. That's what pays for all of that military equipment you're going to talk about later in this show, and pays the soldiers' salaries and medical care for them. And there's a complete misconnection here, and I guess the basic rule is that Leona Helmsley was right. Only little people pay taxes.
Well, it is an extraordinary situation, and where the so-called Vichy Republicans are truly showing a complete lack of any moral fiber. But in the case of the surrogates, Governor Christie and Mayor Giuliani for Trump, it's extraordinary that they're out there crowing about what a genius Trump is for not paying taxes. And of course, in the debate, first debate with Hillary Clinton, when he was challenged about not paying taxes, he said, "That makes me smart." How do you think this is playing? I mean, it's extraordinary to think that Trump's got as far as he has, and I, in part, blame the media for giving him all that free airtime and being so uncritical. As
I was the first national journalist the day he announced who said he might get the nomination. Certainly all the free media he got help, but there is a real problem, and Trump is exploiting it, but exploiting it in the way a demagogue does it. The bottom half of Americans are in living in economic terror. In many states, if you lose your job and employers can fire you for any reason, because unlike other modern countries, we don't have labor laws that protect workers, you may get, like a woman who called me the other day, you get fired for actually doing her job. She did her job, and they didn't want her to do it correctly. They fired her. She waited 2 weeks. She applied for unemployment. She got a letter 3 weeks later saying, "Well, in 5 weeks, we'll look at your claim because we don't have enough claims examiners." And when she got on the phone, they told her, "Oh, you know, it'll be 3 or 4 months till she can get unemployment if she gets it." And in that state, about half of people who lose their jobs don't qualify for various reasons. So people are living in terror. They're working harder. They're in debt, and they're making less money. And Trump is appealing to these people by claiming he'll fix it all, when his history is cheating workers out of their pay. A judge found that he did this, engaged in a conspiracy to do that, cheating vendors out of their money. And he's able to get away with this because there's a group of people who are so troubled that they don't care. They just want to hear the message about this. That he will save them. What matters here is the people who are undecided in the battleground states. And if those people say, "Well, I don't care if he doesn't pay taxes and I have to pay taxes," he's going to become the next president of the United States. If they say, "Hey, wait a minute, am I a chump? I'm having all these taxes taken out of my paycheck. I'm paying my taxes and this guy is riding around in his private 757 and doesn't pay taxes," then he's going to lose. And I don't know what we're going to see out of that, but that's what matters. His base believes that he's who he thinks he is, which is genetically superior to us, the greatest businessman of all time, and the only person, I alone, he says, who can fix our problems.
Well, just in closing then, David K. Johnson, already Trump's, one of his attorneys has threatened to sue the New York Times to promptly initiate an appropriate legal action.
He has no ground. I mean, he can sue. Anybody can sue.
Right.
But a newspaper that receives documents and did not participate in taking them cannot be successfully sued for that. There's a distinct possibility Trump himself is the source of these documents. Trump has a long history of leaking things himself, and the Times did say that the envelope said Trump Tower on it. I mean, how many people have access to these particular documents to send them to the Times? Mm-hmm. But that's just bluster and noise for people who don't understand the legal system. I mean, Trump called me in April when I was working on the making of Donald Trump and threatened to sue me, and it was before I started working on it, but working on a magazine article ahead of it. And if he does, if he loses, he may sue me over this book, but he has no grounds.
Sure. But why would he leak these documents? Is this damage control? Is the story worse than what these documents indicate?
Oh, if he thinks that it will help him, you know, if Trump believes, you and I may think this is outrageous, but he may think that this will help him. I mean, remember, this is a man who spent 5 days going after a Miss Universe from 20 years ago that nobody knew who she was because of the odd ways that he views and does things. And he is almost certainly the source of the audio tape earlier this year, where he claimed it wasn't him on the audio tape, and it was about these famous women like Madonna and Kim Basinger, he claimed were pounding on his bedroom door when he didn't even know them. And I go through that in a chapter in The Making of Donald Trump called Imaginary Lovers. I mean, he does very strange things because emotionally Donald Trump is a 12 or 13-year-old boy. His emotional development basically stopped when his father sent him off to a military academy because he was such a troublemaker and malcontent, and he was constantly getting into trouble. And he listen to the way he talks, the way he attacks things. He's trapped in the 13-year-old mind, and, you know, what a terrible thing. I mean, 13 is a terrible age when you're growing up.
Right. Well, let's hand over the nuclear codes to this 13-year-old. I thank you for joining us, David K. Johnston.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David K. Johnston, who's an investigative journalist and winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Journalism, a longtime reporter for the New York Times. He's also the author of several New York Times bestsellers, including Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch, and won the IRE Medal and the George Polk Award for his investigative reporting. He's a columnist for The Daily Beast, National Memo, and USA Today, and his latest book is The Making of Donald Trump. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into today's referendum in Hungary.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way of saying goodbye. I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
You taught me everything I know about taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Peter Krecko, who's a visiting Fulbright Scholar at the Center for Global and International Studies at Indiana University and the director of the Political Capital Institute in Budapest, Hungary. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Krecko.
Hi, thank you for the opportunity.
And there is a referendum underway in Hungary today, called by Prime Minister Viktor Orban to reject a EU scheme that would settle about 1,300 asylum seekers in Hungary. It doesn't look as if the referendum has reached the 50% turnout to make it valid, but it also appears to be a political ploy on the part of the right-wing Prime Minister to bolster his position ahead of elections, playing on xenophobia and this belief or this feeling in Hungary that migration equals terrorism, and that what is happening to Europe is the dilution of European Christian culture.
Yes, in Hungary, there is the election process right now. So the ballot boxes are open currently, and we don't know if it will be valid by the end or not. But it seems to be rather likely that it will be invalid, which means that the turnout will not reach 50%. And if it won't be valid, I think it will be, to a certain extent, a failure for the Hungarian government who initiated this referendum, even if they will communicate it as a huge success. They predicted beforehand that it will be rather valid. But on the other hand, even if it won't be valid, there will be around 3 million voters who turn up at the ballot boxes and vote with no, which means that they are rejecting the EU refugee quota system as the government wanted them. So anyway, it will be a dramatic moment, I think, for Hungarian politics, because it was the most xenophobic campaign we could have observed since the fall of communism in Hungary. And also it will be a dramatic moment for Europe, because more and more it seems that populist right-wing politicians want to undermine the integrity of the European Union via such referendum processes. And I think besides the negative consequences on the domestic political level, this kind of European disintegration is something that absolutely favors Russia and in line with Vladimir Putin's interests.
Well, Orbán, whose Fidesz party, of course, is in power, and there's the even further to the right party, Jobbik, which are their sort of so-called volunteers, are involved in vigilante activities on the borders with Serbia and Romania, where the Hungarians have built razor wire fences and they beat up these poor, unfortunate migrants. So, but Orbán himself has also flirted with Vladimir Putin, and he has called for a cultural counter-revolution within Europe, and he has praised the kind of strongman aspects of Russia's Vladimir Putin's rule and Turkey's Erdogan's capture of essentially turning Turkish democracy into an autocracy. So he seems to be a bit of an outlier. Is his agenda in line with Putin's, which is essentially to break up the European Federation by encouraging right-wing nationalism?
Yeah, I think it was a perfect description of the main goals of Viktor Orbán. Orbán himself expects that there will be a huge change, not just only in European politics, but in world politics more general. A new era is coming where nationalist populist politicians who were rather outliers and outsiders and extremes beforehand will become the major drivers of world politics. He thinks that the refugee crisis will sweep away politicians in Europe, such as Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, Juncker, the leader of the European Commission, Holland, the French president, and there will be a new era of right-wing politicians, such as Marine Le Pen and Strache and others. And also, he is one of the very few politicians who openly supported Donald Trump during the presidential campaign. And I think he dared to do it because his bet is that Trump will be the winner. And he hopes that politicians who have a nationalist agenda and who are against this liberal mainstream in the world will become the mainstream in the future. And Donald Trump's presidency would be totally in line with his interests and, of course, with Vladimir Putin's interests as well. So the most dangerous aspect of this whole story, I think, is that there seems to be a big coalition of autocratic leaders, of right-wing politicians, and even Vladimir Putin, and in Hungary, we can totally observe it. And most of the right-wing populist Eurosceptic politicians in Europe are strongly favoring Vladimir Putin's Russia.
So there's clearly evidence of, I don't know whether because of Russia's economic straits that has dried up. But in general, there's a bigger picture here, I think. The New York Times carried a story a couple of days ago talking about how Putin's strategy is to just to create mischief. And it does seem that he's being very successful in a low-cost way, you know, cyber warfare or cyber espionage or cyber manipulation is very inexpensive, particularly when you've got a bunch of a loose federation of hackers sitting in their bedrooms and basements, etc. And then in Syria, things are getting to a head now because Putin is being so flagrant, along with the Assad regime, who he's supporting, within these barbaric bombings of hospitals, etc., and at the same time warning the US not to strike out against the Syrian regime that he's supporting. So it's a kind of one-sided situation there where the Russians are openly have intervened to rescue the Syrian regime of Assad. And what they're doing is that they're beating up on what's left of the so-called moderate Sunni opposition, so that the U.S. will be only left with the real radical jihadis like the Islamic State and al-Nusra. And at the same time, the Russians are bolstering the Assad regime. So that, it seems to be clearly their strategy. And I'm not sure, you know, they've been stringing John Kerry, the Secretary of State, along for months now. Do you think this situation could come to a head? Obama clearly doesn't want to get involved. But on the other hand, I think they're getting kind of fed up with being made a fool of by Putin.
Yes, the very unfortunate situation, I think not only in the United States, but even in Europe, is that while the more and more aggressive, influencing attempts to political issues are becoming visible, no one really wants to go into a confrontation, a strong confrontation with Russia. And I think there are much more politicians that would be rather happy to return to business as usual. While I do think that in the current situation it would be both morally and pragmatically bad, for the reason that, yes, what happens right now in Syria, even according to the leaders of the United Nations, is a war crime. It's crimes against humanity. And this is a very cynical game, yes, to practically completely abolish the moderate opposition, its civil basis, with practically cluster bombs and other aspects. And coming back to European politics, but I think even U.S. politics, the ones who admire Vladimir Putin should acknowledge and should be faced with the fact that they are supporting practically a war criminal at the current circumstances. And there are a lot of contradictions in European politics, for example. When politicians are calling for totally stopping the refugee inflow, and at the same time they are supporting Vladimir Putin's Russia, that on the side of the Assad regime is contributing the most to the refugee crisis, with killing the civilian population and leading to a lot of people have to leave their homes in Syria and Iraq. So there are a lot of contradictions in this regard. But when it comes when it comes to Syria, yes, I think Russia was mainly successful in keeping Assad in power, and it was their main goal, their main achievement. On the other hand, if we look at Europe and if we look in the United States, I think the attempts to influence politics are, I think, more just spectacular, dirty little tricks instead of something really serious. Even if Europe is quite weak nowadays, and Russia can impose some influence in politics, this is not most of the weaknesses of the European Union are not caused by Russia. Russia just wants to benefit from them. And I think the same with the United States. There are politicians who are supporting Vladimir Putin, and this is an issue. But I don't think, for example, that Russia would be able to really influence the outcome of the elections in the United States. With the cyber attacks, I think they are just sending a message to their own electorate and to the world that the United States is facing a lot of problems and they can't defend their own electoral system. But it's not able, I think, to really dramatically change the outcome. And generally, I think Russia's power in influencing world politics is exaggerated, I think, which is in line with Putin's interest, because he seems to be much stronger than he really is. The Russian regime is facing very serious economic hardships. The system is running out of cash, and they face, I think, the threat of indebtedness. I think they won't have too much resource in the future to extend their influence economically, and that's what they try to compensate via political tools. But generally, in a lot of cases, I think they do more harm than good, even for their own vested interests.
Well, that seems to be the record of Putin, that he's brilliant at tactics, but he fails strategically with the big picture. For example, by starting a war with Ukraine, he's essentially created a great deal of concern in Eastern Europe with the Poles, the Czechs, and the Baltic states, along with the Ukrainians, who are now, you know, building up their defenses. But that doesn't mean that Putin couldn't create enormous problems for Western Europe, because as you pointed out, there is a connection between Putin's activities in Syria and the refugee crisis in Europe. Shortly after Putin intervened in Syria and started to bomb the hell out of the place, that created this massive exodus that we saw about a million Syrians showing up in Greece and then throughout Europe. And he can do that again, because at the end of the day, if his project succeeds in Syria, where he brings back the Assad government to power, and the West stuck, the US and the West are stuck supporting these crazy jihadists, what will happen surely then is that the Assad regime will essentially drive out the Sunnis, who represent the majority, and then there'll be a massive exodus of refugees from Syria, dwarfing the previous one, and that's going to put more pressure on Western Europe. And all he has to do is ramp up attacks on Ukraine to create a refugee crisis in Ukraine itself. So I think he has some options to create even greater mischief.
Yes, I would agree. I don't want to underestimate the threat that Russia poses on Western Europe and also on the United States. So in the West, on the Western world in general. But I do think that with a more coordinated, more conscious, and I think more confrontative political approach, the attempts of Russia to create more mess and chaos in the world could be quite easily stopped. And I think the biggest problem is that the all these countries, I think, the Western countries, are so much dealing with their own domestic problems that they don't really see this kind of strategic threat and don't have a coordinated policy to deal with. While for example, when it comes to the economic sanctions, this is mainly, I think, because of the pressure of the United States that they are still in place in Europe as well, because there are a lot of EU leaders that would be happier to end the sanctions and not suffer all the economic consequences and return to business as usual. Why I think that if Europe returns to business as usual with Russia now, it would be something as a total surrender to Russia, and it should be avoided. So yes, I think Russia can create more problems, no question about it. But when it comes, for example, to the refugee crisis, yes, they contribute to it unquestionably via the direct military intervention. But the refugee crisis began before their intervention. Okay, they have supported Assad even beforehand, but I think that even in the refugee crisis, the role of Russia is important, but they are not the only players who are driving it. Usually they just try to pour salt in the wound, and this is what they do everywhere, but most of the wounds are already there, so they don't cause the wounds, they are just bringing the salt.
I understand, but if Putin and Assad were to win in Syria, the consequences, given the vicious and vindictive nature of this murderous Assad regime, the Sunnis, I think, will be driven out of the country. And they are the majority. I can't see any other scenario. And where will they go?
Yeah, I agree. I agree. It's a major threat. And I think right now that I think the world's eyes in Syria, and especially Aleppo, this is a moment where there is a need to think over the strategy so far. There have been quite a lot of, let's say, realistic foreign policy discussions that said that, yes, to fight against ISIS, Assad is a natural, and Russia is a natural ally. But I think it should be realized that this is absolutely not the case, because they are just following their own agenda, which is and part of that is quite destructive to the Western world. So I do think that right now that this is a topic even in United Nations and everywhere in policy discussions. Very serious messages should be sent to Russia that it must be the end of this game, because if not, then they will face very serious consequences. Let's say, for example, that these sanctions themselves, that I think are important, but these are very weak sanctions. An economist friend of mine called them the Mickey Mouse sanctions, compared to, for example, what Iran has faced beforehand. So I think that there would be a lot of tools in the hands of Western political leaders to push back the attempts of Russia, without a direct military confrontation, which of course should be avoided. But I think the major problem is that there have been just so many empty talk without any consequences. And I think this is how Putin's regime works. They, I think, just understand the language of the power, and the brutal force sometimes, and doesn't really understand the don't want to understand the language of diplomacy. So the toolkit should be, yeah, I think, revised.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Peter Krecko.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Peter Krecko, who's a visiting Fulbright Scholar at the Center for Global and International Studies at Indian University and the director of the Political Capital Institute in Budapest, Hungary. And we're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Hillary Clinton's break with President Obama on nuclear modernization. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Joseph Cirincione, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed nonproliferation and international policy programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, has also worked on the professional staffs of the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations, and served as a staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joe Cirincione.
Pleasure to be with you, Ian.
And Joe, first of all, there was an interesting op-ed by the former Secretary of Defense, William Perry, in Friday's New York Times, along with a story that indicates that at a private fundraiser, Hillary Clinton's audio was hacked, and it appeared on a conservative website. And in the audio, she's in a Q&A session. She's asked about President Obama's trillion-dollar nuclear modernization program, and she basically broke with Obama and said she was against the nuclear-tipped cruise missile, which is one of the Pentagon's pet projects, saying that it's the last thing we need. So that's a pretty interesting turn of events. I mean, I find it quite ironic that the conservatives would be leaking this to hurt Hillary Clinton when, in fact, her biggest problem is with the left of the Democratic Party, who thinks she's a hawk. And here she's clearly indicating she's a lot less hawkish than President Obama.
Well, that's a very interesting point, Ian. You know, Hillary Clinton is very strong on national security, and she does have the side of her that tends to be favor more interventions than President Obama has, and historically has tended to support a larger defense budget. But she is faced with some overwhelming budget realities, and she knows this, and her key advisors know this, that we're in a period of declining defense budgets while we have a legacy of programs that were planned before the defense budget started to decline that is creating this procurement bow wave. In other words, we've decided to buy more than we can afford to buy. So something has to go. And this is particularly true of the $1 trillion that are planned to be spent on new nuclear weapons over the next 30 years. So she understands, and this is what you hear her saying in this hacked interview, that something's got to go, that we can't afford all the weapons we've ordered. And then she singles out this particularly destabilizing weapon, a new nuclear cruise missile. And again, she understands this, some of her advisors understand this, that the risks of having various cruise missiles, some with nuclear weapons on them, some without, means that in a conflict, a foe might not know what missile is heading towards them. And it could trigger a nuclear response accidentally or by miscalculation. So she's saying, and I'm delighted to hear this, that this is one of the weapons she would consider cutting.
Well, but in general, can you say, or can you interpret from these hacked remarks at this fundraiser whether or not Hillary Clinton has a more sensible approach to the nuclear arsenal? Because one of the things that concerns me, and in fact, you talked about it in the last time we spoke, you said the greatest concern is that we shouldn't be emphasizing nuclear weapons, we should be de-emphasizing them. And furthermore, the real issue is the 5 minutes that an American president has to decide whether or not to retaliate or face nuclear annihilation. And not that the retaliation won't end up with the same results, but that is the nature of deterrence. And we have this system left over from the Cold War that hasn't changed, where you have essentially a nuclear hair trigger. And so is she more sensible in that regard?
You've characterized it exactly right, Ian. And the answer is we don't know yet. This will be one of the key struggles in a Clinton administration. She will have advisors on both sides. She herself has two sides on this. She wants to be strong. She wants to protect against the far right, criticizing her for being weak on national security. This is why someone leaked this, to try to portray her as weak. But she understands that we face real nuclear dangers, And some of the weapons we have are dinosaurs left over from the Cold War that don't do anything to address the 21st century threats we have. They don't help us with ISIS. They don't help us with Russia in Crimea. They don't help us on any of the real threats we face. Bill Perry, former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry, Bill Clinton's Secretary of Defense, wrote a brilliant op-ed in the New York Times this Friday saying that we can safely cut our nuclear force. And he singled out both this cruise missile and the entire ICBM fleet, these 450 nuclear-armed missiles that we have in silos in Midwest prairies. These are the ones that cause the hair trigger situation. These are the ones that a president would have to decide to fire if he thought he was under or she was under attack or risk losing. Perry says you can get rid of these, you can stabilize the nuclear situation, we're safer without them, and it greatly extends the decision time a president would have to make before making what perhaps is the most fateful decision any president would ever have to make.
So turning to William Perry's op-ed in Friday's New York Times, why it's safe to scrap America's ICBMs, he's basically saying that this part of the triad, which needless to say, Donald Trump didn't know what the nuclear triad is, and we can get into the general disquiet of the notion of Donald Trump having the nuclear codes or access to the button, as it's called. But that's another issue. The point about the land-based leg of the triads is that these are a kind of counterforce weapon, aren't they? The idea that if a salvo coming from Russia would be aimed at these silos because they're fixed targets. You can't necessarily find the submarines, but you can certainly find these targets under the prairies, and they would be the first targets in what's called a counterforce strike. So therefore, the incentive is to have the Russians hit empty silos to launch on warning. So that's the situation, is it not, Joe?
Yes, and this was the situation set up during the Cold War when we all thought we'd be fighting a global thermonuclear war. But that Cold War ended 25, almost 30 years ago now, and yet we still have these weapons. Perry's saying we can safely downsize, and he makes two very important points. One, we can get rid of the ICBMs. The nuclear triad is not the Holy Trinity. There is nothing sacred or strategically sound about having bombers plus subs plus ground-based missiles. You can get rid of the ground-based missiles, and you are more stable. You are safer than if you have them in the first place. And then he's saying, look, we should size our nuclear force for what we genuinely think we need. It doesn't matter if the Russians have a couple of hundred more or even 1,000 more. We can deter the Russians or any other aggressor with just hundreds of nuclear weapons. We don't need the 5,000 we have in our arsenal. And you do that, you're not only safer, you're also saving hundreds of billions of dollars. The new nuclear-armed ICBM alone is going to cost over $100 billion. The nuclear cruise missile, at least $30 billion. And those are just the current estimates. Those are sure to rise, as all major defense programs do.
So given the very strained relations now with Russia, particularly over Syria, where Vladimir Putin and Lavrov have been stringing Secretary of State Kerry along for some time, and there's so much frustration on the American side at the barbaric Russian indiscriminate bombing of hospitals and civilians in Aleppo, and apparently President Obama simply does not want to get involved, but now Russia's warning the U.S., not to strike out against Assad. So there's a clear double standard. Russia's intervened to protect Assad, but in doing so, Putin's going after the moderate opposition that the U.S. backs and leaving the Americans and the West with this unpalatable detritus of the al-Nusra and the radical elements of the Islamic State. It looks as if at the end of the day, if Putin wins and Assad is back in power, he'll effectively drive out all of the Sunnis, and then you'll have another refugee crisis in Europe, and that will further destabilize Europe, all of which appears to be a strategy of Putin's. So you have a pretty testy situation. How do you inject into that situation some rationality with Putin to have a one-on-one with him about, you know, we've got the football, you got the Cheget, and, you know, it's a crazy system, and we got to figure out that we can't have the fate of the planet resting on a five-minute decision window.
Right. So you're exactly right that it does appear that Putin is intentionally increasing the chaos in Syria in order to force migration with the purpose, perhaps secondary, perhaps main purpose, of destabilizing Western Europe. Some people are starting to talk about the weaponization of migration, using this as a strategic weapon. But here's the point. Nuclear weapons have nothing to do with this. They don't help us one way or another. They don't deter Russia. They don't deal with Assad. They don't deal with ISIS. Nuclear weapons are irrelevant to this conflict, in fact, to all the conflicts that we currently face. So we don't need to carry over the burden, both on our force structure and on our budgets, of this obsolete Cold War nuclear arsenal. We can safely cut. And those are the kinds of situations Hillary's going to have to confront early on in her administration. Can you do business with the Russians? Bill Perry says, look, first of all, we should just size the arsenal for what we think is right. We currently have about 1,500 strategic nuclear weapons. I know Bill Perry believes we can go much lower, below 1,000. And it doesn't matter what the Russians have, because you just need a few hundred max to deter any foe. How many nuclear weapons are you actually ever going to possibly use without generating a planetary catastrophe? The second thing is, can you negotiate with the Russians? Is it possible that even while you have a conflict with them, you can negotiate on the strategic nuclear level? Yes. We did it all the time with the Soviet Union. We weren't at peace. We had a cold peace with the Russians, but Nixon negotiated with them, Reagan negotiated with them. You can see that you can make a deal at the strategic level, even though you have major differences in regions. Even when we were fighting the Vietnam War, when Russia and China were arming our enemies, we were still negotiating with them about nuclear weapons. You can do these two things at the same time. History has proved it's the only practical way to proceed.
Well, indeed, the Chinese have shown that you don't need that many weapons to have deterrence. Right? They've got like two.
Exactly. They have about 200, and they deter us just fine. Right. We're not going to risk a war with China. They have about 60 that might be able to reach the United States. So that's just 60 weapons. Again, we have over almost 2,000 that we could rain down on China, and yet we're deterred by a fraction of that arsenal. It doesn't take that many nuclear weapons to deter someone from attacking you.
But you have to add to that, though, I think the Chinese also have a very devious, shall we say, policy, where they have helped, apparently, covertly, North Korea get its nuclear program. They won't do anything about reining in the North Koreans because that adds a kind of wild card to the deterrence, because, you know, that means that all of America's military assets in and around China are threatened by North Korea, which the Chinese are happy about. And after all, it was the Chinese who gave the Pakistanis the nuclear bomb, which they used to deter India, which is a potential strategic rival of China's. So there's also another game going on here, isn't there?
There absolutely is. And China used to think that proliferation was good. Under Mao, remember, they got their bomb in 64. He thought lots of countries should have nuclear weapons, kind of like what Donald Trump is saying now. And so he assisted Pakistan in getting their bomb. He assisted North Korea in the early stages of that program as well. They changed their position when they started to see what that meant, where that led to. So as far as we know, China is not helping Pakistan now. There seems to be some missile technology from China that has flowed into North Korea. We're still trying to track that down. Their recent rocket engine test appears to be a Chinese-supplied engine. So that is another crisis that Hillary Clinton's going to have to deal with. Jane Harman, who's the head of the Woodrow Wilson Center, just wrote a terrific op-ed on saying we need to negotiate with North Korea. The Obama policy of ignoring them hasn't worked. The Bush policy of trying to strangle them into submission didn't work. It's time to learn the lessons from the successful Iran deal and understand that we can negotiate with a country, even one as difficult as North Korea, to freeze the program, to at least least stop it from getting any worse, to put a cap on the capability they have, and then see if those talks are successful, whether we can then proceed to roll it back. There are things that North Korea wants from us. They want security assurances. They want recognition. What are they willing to give up to get them? That's what President Clinton's going to have to find out.
Well, clearly, North Korea and Pakistan are the flashpoints, aren't they, for any possible nuclear use of a nuclear weapons. And Pakistan has the fastest growing arsenal on the planet, and it's a state sponsor of terrorism underneath the nuclear umbrella. So that's a pretty daunting task there.
Yes. Most experts believe if we're going to see a nuclear weapon used in combat, it will be in South Asia. Because of the Pakistan program, the instability in that country, the radical Islamic forces that are operating inside the military and intelligence apparatus, Al-Qaeda and ISIS operating inside the country, an ongoing conflict with their nuclear-armed neighbor, India, that is just a confluence of risk factors that make a nuclear conflict more probable than any place else. And now you add North Korea, who in the last 18 months has greatly accelerated both their nuclear and missile program. North Korea has tested more missiles in the past 18 months than they have in their entire previous history. So these two crises are growing, are increasing. These are going to be tremendous challenges for the next president. You want to make sure you've got somebody in that job who has some sense of how to deal with these, how to calmly talk to people, and has a kind of background and a group of advisors who can wrestle with some of the most difficult security decisions we're going to face for the rest of this decade and beyond.
And who doesn't have the emotional maturity of a 13-year-old?
We have never faced a situation where someone like Donald Trump has been this close to the nuclear command and control structure. People are just learning, and they're surprised that the president and the president alone has the authority to launch a nuclear war. No one can overrule him. There would have to be a mutiny against the president who decided to use nuclear weapons for whatever reason the president wants.
Right,
there's no vote. There's no discussion. So you better be sure that the person who's close to that button has the kind of your confidence that they will make the right decision.
Well, we've run out of time, and I thank you very much for joining us, Joseph Cirincione.
Thank you very much, Ian. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Joseph Cirincione, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund and the author of Bomb Scare, the History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.